and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Monday, December 7th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Looking at the front page, we have a colorful picture of a man dressed in a Santa Claus suit, ringing a bell, and also holding a leash on, looks like, three dogs. Maybe it's just one dog, I can't tell. Three dogs, two dogs, anyway. He's running down the sidewalk toward us. And the headline, Jolly Jogger Helps Bring Joy. And this is reported by Jeff Montgomery. About a dozen years ago, Tom Goodman absentmindedly placed a Santa hat atop his head and departed for a run. The hat, a prop he had obtained from his Christmas caroling group, wasn't meant to be a statement. It was merely a way to stay warm on a brisk early winter day. More than a decade later, though, that impromptu run has evolved into a joyous tradition. Goodman now embarks on about a half dozen Santa runs each holiday season, winding through the west end of Dubuque with his dogs in tow. "It's something that kind of took on a life of its own," he said. "It became clear to me that this is making people happy. Now I feel like I have to do this every year." Goodman, an attorney who lives in Dubuque, admits that he never intended for his runs to become a local phenomenon. Piece by piece, however, the lighthearted gesture picked up steam. He began waving to walkers and motorists during his runs and continued to add new elements to his wardrobe, including a pair of Santa shorts that he wears over his running tights. The runs usually took off, though, when Goodman decided to dress his dogs in small Santa suits of their own. Suddenly, he was earning honks from well over 100 drivers on most of his runs. Goodman said the responses vary. Some drivers pull over to take a picture with Goodman. Others try to capture a video of him. Dubuque resident Jenny Loney struck up a friendship with Goodman years ago, in part due to their mutual love of running and biking. Today, she's among the large contingent of Dubuque residents who keep their eyes peeled for the runner in the Santa costume. "There are people who look forward to it every year," she said. "The walkers and the people who are driving by just love it. I think he spreads a lot of joy." On its face, the notion of running in a Santa suit seems to be a simple, even silly gesture. For Goodman, though, it's part of an active lifestyle that keeps his mind and body occupied. Goodman works as a public defender, and he acknowledged that the stresses of his job often linger with him. "We deal with some pretty nasty stuff on occasion," he said. "This is a good way to get out and try to find some balance." But the true turning point came when Goodman learned how his straightforward gesture impacted others. About 4 years ago, a driver stopped Goodman as he was about to wrap up his run. Goodman assumed that the motorist wanted to take a video or snap a quick picture. Instead, the man asked if he could shake Goodman's hand. Then the stranger poured his heart out. He told Goodman about the nightmarish year he had endured, about how he had recently lost a loved one and learned soon thereafter that he had stage 4 cancer. The tragedies had dampened the stranger's holiday joy. But in some small way, seeing Goodman and his dogs fully adorned in their Santa costumes had brightened his outlook. The stranger's story struck a chord with Goodman. "I was crying all the way home," he said. Up to that point, this whole thing was just kind of for fun. "I didn't realize how powerful it could be. I didn't realize how you can touch somebody by doing something really simple." For Goodman and his dogs, a typical run spans between 4 and 5 miles. He usually heads out toward Asbury Road before turning onto the northwest arterial. From there, he runs toward Kennedy Road before looping back to his house. An avid runner, Goodman has completed multiple marathons over the years. Even so, he said that completing the Santa runs hasn't always been an easy task. A few years ago, Goodman continued the tradition despite having a torn meniscus, a decision that ultimately led to a long-term injury. Goodman recalls that it took nearly 10 months to heal. "I definitely paid for it," he said with a chuckle. Recently, his running mates have begun to show their own signs of age. One of Goodman's dogs, a Labrador retriever, has hip dysplasia and is no longer able to accompany his owner on runs. His two Vislas are 10 and 11 years old, and cannot log the same mileage they once did. Goodman himself isn't always in the mood to go for a run. Finding the time isn't always easy. Aches and pains and inclement weather can make the prospect of a run unappealing. Even so, Goodman and his dogs plan to complete at least one run each weekend until Christmas. He hopes to keep the spectacle alive for years to come. After years of loud honks and the occasional heartfelt connection, the local holiday tradition has no end in sight. "I will keep going as long as my body lets me," Goodman said. At the bottom of the front page, schools address mental health. This is reported by Allie Hinga from Platteville, Wisconsin. Platteville School District students feeling overwhelmed can access resources to help them calm down regardless of whether they're in school at school. When the COVID-19 pandemic forced students to switch to virtual learning earlier this year, staff developed a virtual calming room website with links to mental health resources, relaxing sounds and music, meditations, and other tools. That means that even if students can't visit their school counselor in person, they can still access resources on their own. It gives them one more thing to choose from on their menu of what works for them to calm down and just be, said Dickie Feldman, school counselor at Platteville Middle School. The changes brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic have local educators particularly aware of students' mental health needs this fall. At the same time, though, many students are physically at school less often, if at all. Despite alterations to the school day, local educators say they are finding ways to get supports to students who need them. "We are making an effort not to let any students fall through the cracks, and we are really making the effort to connect," said Shirley Horseman, Executive Director of Student Services for Dubuque Community Schools. While it's difficult to gauge whether Dubuque's school counselors are seeing more mental health issues this year compared to others, staff are particularly aware of student mental health needs this year, Horstman said. "The COVID-19 pandemic has altered many students' socialist structures," she said. "Students who are attending school in person are only physically at school every other day. They've also had to adjust to wearing masks and social distancing at school. When you think of all those things, they can be very isolating for students, especially our students who are very social and thrive on that," Horstman said. Kate Kramer, a Maquoketa Middle School counselor, said she has noticed an uptick in anxiety among students and staff as they deal with uncertainties caused by the pandemic. "There is also a greater need for grief counseling as both young people and staff deal with COVID-19 deaths. Because it's such a roller coaster right now, my biggest thing has been to understand that those students and teachers that I've gotten to know well, I'm going to see really different things from them this year," she said. As Dubuque School's officials are taking note of students' mental health needs, most students are physically on campus half as often as usual, while others are learning fully remotely. Still, educators have systems in place to catch students who need support, Horstman said. Teachers regularly check in with students. If they notice a student acting differently than usual or struggling, they can refer the child to the school counselor who follows up with the student or the parents. "There are many different ways that we are really trying to reach out to students that we are not seeing each and every day," Horstman said. She acknowledged that staying connected can be more challenging with students learning fully virtually, but staffers still are working to build connections. School counselors who have worked with particular students before know how to reach to them routinely. Parents also reach out when they notice something seems off with their children. Amanda DeWolf, a Maquoketa High School counselor, said teachers have been good about checking in with students learning virtually to figure out what they need and help them connect with their peers. "Students and families have remained willing to stay connected," DeWolf said. "Community partners that provide school-based therapy have been able to continue working with students too." Michelle Kellogg, school psychologist for the Platteville School District, said that she and the school counselor, social worker, and nurse have been offering virtual sessions for families to learn about topics such as strategies for virtual learning and self-care. That, in turn, allows families to better support their students. Feldman said Platteville Middle School students learning in person spend much of their day with the same teacher, so the teacher gets to know students well enough to notice if they need help. Students learning remotely check in regularly with the teacher, who gets to know them and can refer students to counseling staff if they notice a student needs support. If you're not engaged in class, if they stop attending classes through Zoom, or they're not completing work, it's evidenced very quickly, and we can reach out, she said. The article is accompanied by pictures of a couple of those mentioned, Shirley Horstman and Kate Kramer. And a third story on the front page by Jeff Montgomery. This is this Biz Buzz. Boutique aims to be great fit. Biz Buzz shares business tidbits from around the tri-state area. This week we highlight developments in Dubuque and Maquoketa, Iowa. A new retail store in downtown Dubuque offers clothing aimed at appealing to all women. AJ's Boutique opened its doors at 129 Main Street in mid-November, according to owner Amanda Kaiser. The business sells dresses, shirts, sweaters, pants, and a wide variety of accessories geared toward women, Kaiser said. Sizes range from extra small to 3XL. Said Kaiser, "I wanted to have a place where, whatever size you were, you could come in and find something and feel good about yourself in it." AJ's Boutique occupies a storefront that long housed Knipple's Religious Goods, a store that moved to 129 Main Street in 1969 and remained there for roughly five decades. Kaiser believes her store will add a new element to the lower Main District, which is populated mostly by bars and restaurants. In addition to clothing, AJ's Boutique offers accessories such as hats and jewelry, and a modest collection of home decor. Kaiser eventually hopes to introduce clothing for men and children, as well as other items such as furniture. Kaiser acknowledged she is taking a risk by opening the business, but she decided to make the leap after feeling unfulfilled at her previous corporate job. "This past year has put things in perspective," she said. "I realize life is too short to not do something you love. When I am here, it doesn't feel like work." AJ's Boutique is open 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday, and noon to 3 p.m. on Sunday. Customers also can purchase items by visiting their website, shopajsboutique.com. A second item, pet store to expand. A Dubuque business specializing in pet care and products will soon undertake a major expansion by making only a short move. Kelly Dressler, owner of Wags 2 Wiggles, said the business will open a new expanded location, 1838 Central Avenue, in early January. That space remains occupied by Upscale Dubuque, a creative reuse center and art gallery that plans to close this month. Dressler noted that the new location is just a few storefronts down from the existing one, presenting an ideal scenario for her growing business. "We knew we needed to expand, but we didn't want to leave the block. We wanted to stay down here," she said. "It is sad to see Upcycle Dubuque leave, but the space works great for us." Wags 2 Wiggles, the 2 is a letter, is the numeral 2, Wags 2 Wiggles, opened in December 2019, originally focusing primarily on the sale of pet supplies. It later introduced grooming services, which are now provided to more than 300 clients. "We have completely changed our business model since opening," Dressler said. "The new space, which will offer roughly twice the square footage as the existing one, will allow Dressler to vastly expand grooming capacity and hire another full-time groomer, bringing her total employment to 4 workers. Wags 2 Wiggles will also introduce day boarding for dogs. Dressler emphasized that these pets will get one-on-one time with staff members and won't be intermingled with other pets. Wags to Wiggles will remain open at its current location through Christmas Eve. It will then close for a few weeks while the new location is set up. Dressler anticipates opening the new storefront in the second week of January. Wags to Wiggles can be reached at the phone number 563-663-2411. And another item, sanitation business to close. After serving local customers for over six decades, a Maquoketa-based sanitation business will soon cease operations. Rockwell Cleanup will close on December 31, according to co-owner Cecil Rockwell. He said the decision was prompted by an illness in the family. "It's tough," he said. "I've been doing it for so long, and quite a few of these customers have been with us for a lot of years." Cecil's father, Ronald "Rocky" Rockwell, started the business in 1956. Cecil came into the family business in 1979 and now co-owns it with his brother Jeff. Rockwell Cleanup picked up garbage for a mix of residential and business customers. Its garbage routes served clients in Maquoketa, Baldwin, and Sprague, Cecil said. Reflecting on the longevity of the operation, Cecil emphasized that the business stayed viable by keeping things simple. "We kept our customers because we always kept our word with them," he said. "Our business grew through word of mouth." Rockwell Cleanup is located at 5533 Hurstville Road. It can be reached at the phone number 563-652-5052. On page 3, we have the Dubuque and Tri-State page and a few news and brief items. Funding available to eligible residents facing eviction. A Dubuque organization has received funding to assist eligible low-income residents who are at imminent risk of eviction. Community Solutions of Eastern Iowa has received $25,000, according to a press release from the office of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. The release states that the funding is part of nearly $9 million in statewide assistance that also will provide support for homeless shelter operations. The funds come from a supplemental appropriation to the Emergency Solutions Grant Program through the Federal CARES Act. Assistance available to eligible residents includes rent and utility payments, legal assistance, application fees, security and utility deposits, moving costs, case management and credit repair. All financial assistance is paid directly to landlords and service providers. From Cassville, Wisconsin, Southwest Wisconsin District announces move to virtual learning. Some students in a Southwest Wisconsin school district will switch to remote learning beginning this week. Cassville School District officials have announced that middle and high school students will move to virtual learning as of today. Elementary school grades, including 4-year-old kindergarten through 6th grades, will remain receiving in-person instruction, according to an announcement posted on social media. The announcement states that the move is a safety measure to reduce the spread of COVID-19 and due to the percentage of middle and high school students under isolation or quarantine orders. The district plans to return to in-person instruction on Wednesday, December 16. And a final item, registration for free food distribution opens today in Dubuque. A free food distribution will be held from noon to 3 p.m. Tuesday, December 22nd, at the Multicultural Family Center, 1101 Central Avenue. Space is limited. Register beginning at noon today online at mfcdbq.org/mfc-food-pantry or call 563-582-3681. And now we turn to the opinion page for the first of the View columns, Judge Politicians on Their Policies, Not Waistlines. This is by Scott Reeder, and Scott Reeder is a veteran statehouse journalist and a freelance reporter. Again, the headline on his view is "Judge Politicians on Their Policies, Not Waistlines." We live in a society where it is unacceptable to ridicule a candidate's race or religion, but increasingly a politician's size is fair game. As politics has become increasingly mean-spirited, fat jokes have become more commonplace. Politicians such as former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, current Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and yes, President Donald Trump are subjected to mockery because of their weight. Here's what Democratic consultant James Carville had to say about our president earlier this year on a podcast. "He's a big fat loser, all right. He's so fat." Regular readers of this column know that I'm no fan of Trump, but I find no humor in these remarks, and yes, I realize that Trump has done much to coarsen public discourse during the past 5 years. Still, criticize his ideas, his positions on issues, but not his belt size. Much the same can be said of the cutting remarks I've heard about Pritzker. A commentary on an Illinois conservative website reviews him as Jelly Bean, Jelly Belly, and Jelly Biscuit. Hey, I get it. You don't like his stand on taxes or the pandemic, but what does his weight have to do with those issues? Nothing. Unsuccessful legislative candidate Peter Breen suggested to me several months ago that the reason Pritzker wasn't venturing out of Chicago more was because of his comorbidity. After a long pause, I said, "Are you saying he's too fat?" His response, "Yes." "Sorry, Peter. I'm not a fan of some of the governor's positions either. That said, he has been an engaged governor who works hard. He's actively working and available, more than most of his recent predecessors. I've seen no indication that he is in any way impaired in getting his job done. So, talk about his fiscal policies, not his physical size." Back when I supervised state house reporters in various states, I had a reporter in Trenton, New Jersey, who routinely referred to Christie as Governor Krispy Kreme. During our daily staff meetings, I bit my tongue on a near-daily basis, wanting to say, "Do you realize how stupid and petty that makes you sound?" In hindsight, I should have spoken up. After more than 30 years of covering politicians, I can say usually those who joke about obesity are folks who have never struggled with it themselves. I know the struggle. At one point, I weighed 100 pounds more than I do today. Although I'm now at a healthy weight, I'm humble enough to realize the recidivism rate on weight loss is frighteningly high. Over the past 33 years, my weight has yo-yoed more than a Dunkin' butterfly. It's a daily struggle. Obesity isn't a personal failing, it's a disease. Early in my career, I had a supervisor who continually ridiculed my weight and inferred that I had several other overweight reporters had no business in his newsroom. He was not a nice person. But he was the boss, and I just had to sit there and take it. It always seemed to me that what I wrote, how I reported, or how I otherwise conducted myself as an employee was fair game for him to judge. But what business was it of his or anyone else's what my suit size was? Well, we're here. We're these politicians' bosses. Let's evaluate them the way we would like to be judged. Let's look at their performance, policies, and positions, and leave the measuring tape at home. That was the view expressed by Scott Reeder, a veteran state house journalist and freelance reporter. And we have another opinion by Cynthia Tucker. And Cynthia Tucker won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 2007. She can be reached at cynthia@cynthiatucker.com. If I recall, Cynthia Tucker used to be the editor for the Atlanta Constitution. And she has titled her other view, "Too Many Leaders Think That Rules Don't Apply to Them." With the leader of the free world still in rank denial about the dangers of a raging pandemic and his subordinates following his flat earth edicts, it has been all too easy to focus on the folly among conservatives. Because of President Donald Trump's disdain for the advice of scientific experts, Republican voters around the country are in open defiance of public health regulations. But Trump and his supporters are hardly the only malefactors. Several high-ranking Democrats have shown a propensity for rule-breaking, too, while pretending to be paragons of public health virtue. Their behavior is especially reprehensible because of their breathtaking hypocrisy. Among others, California Governor Gavin Newsom, San Jose, California Mayor Sam Liccardo, San Francisco Mayor London Breed, and Austin, Texas Mayor Steve Adler, all Democrats, have been caught violating the commands they themselves issued. California, like much of the country, is in the midst of a COVID-19 surge. As a result, state and local officials have issued ever stricter guidelines that restrict businesses and constrain ordinary activities such as eating out. In July, the state issued a ban on indoor restaurant dining. Nevertheless, Newsom was photographed in November eating at a very pricey Napa Valley restaurant called the French Laundry. While the governor initially insisted that his party, there were at least a dozen people in his group, including officials of the California Medical Association, adhered to guidelines and ate outside, the room had three walls and a ceiling with a chandelier. I'm from small town Alabama, so I might not understand the codes and conventions of fancy establishments, but that's not my definition of outside. The night after Newsom's gathering, Mayor Breed celebrated a friend's birthday at the French Laundry with several others. They too ate in a three-walled, roofed outdoor room. Less than a month later, the COVID-19 outbreak has forced California officials to issue more stringent orders. Los Angeles County has prohibited gatherings outside immediate family, and Newsom has suggested that a similar statewide order might follow. But given the glaring hypocrisy among officials, how can they expect constituents to pay them any attention? California is not the only place in which Democratic officials have engaged in the do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do school of leadership. On the Wednesday before Thanksgiving Day, Denver Mayor Michael Hancock urged residents of his city to stay home to avoid spreading the novel coronavirus. Avoid travel if you can, he tweeted. About an hour later, according to the Washington Post, he hopped on a plane to travel to Mississippi to join his wife and daughter for Thanksgiving dinner. In his lame apology, Hancock mentioned that his daughter recently started a new job in Mississippi, and he and his wife very much wanted to enjoy the holiday with her. Of course, that's the same reason so many Americans ignored the urgent warnings issued by officials to avoid travel over the Thanksgiving weekend. Didn't they all want to see family members? And then there is Mayor Adler, who cautioned Austin residents in a Facebook video in November as public health officials were warning about a possible COVID-19 spike over the holiday season. He said, "We need to stay home if you can. This is not the time to relax." Oddly, Adler was not at home at the time. He wasn't even in the city. He had jetted off to Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, on a private plane with several other people. After hosting his daughter's wedding in Austin, he left with several other wedding attendees to vacation in a family timeshare, according to the Austin American-Statesman. As Democrats ponder a dispiriting string of down-ballot losses in the November elections, their leaders might consider the travesties of those highfalutin polls. The hypocrisy of their misadventures stands out, but so does the elitism. As California families line up at food banks, Newsom and Breed dined at a restaurant where a typical meal starts at $3.50 for one guest. That's about the libations. That's without the libations. As families in and around Austin struggle to pay rent, Adler traveled to Cabo on a private jet. It is hard to say out of touch any more plainly than that. That was the Our View column by Cynthia Tucker, who won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 2007. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Monday, December 7th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituary. And among our brief funeral service listings, alphabetically, we have first Wendell I. Bennett, Platteville, Wisconsin, visitation 10 a.m., to 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 8, Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. Ida M. Breitbach, Cascade, Iowa. Services 10 a.m. today, St. Martin's Catholic Church, Cascade. Edward J. Dotterwijk, Otter Creek, Iowa. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. today, St. Lawrence Catholic Church, Otter Creek. Services 11 a.m. today at the church. Carolyn M. Gibbs, Portola Valley, California. Visitation 9:30 to 10:30 Wednesday, December 9th, St. Joseph Catholic Church, Bellevue, Iowa. Services 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Hazel M. Grimm, Platteville, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 10:45 a.m. today, St. Rose of Lima Church, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Mass of Christian burial, 11 a.m. today at the church. Lila Hefel, I'm going to spell that, H-E-F-E-L, Lila Hefel, Hefel, Holy Cross, Iowa. Services 11:45 a.m. today, Immaculate Conception Catholic Cemetery, North Buena Vista, Iowa. Harold Hilliard, Dubuque. Services 10:30 Saturday, December 12th, Grandview United Methodist Church, Dubuque. James R. Konzelka, Prairie View, Wisconsin. Visitation 10 a.m. Friday, December 11, St. Gabriel's Church of the Holy Family Parish, Prairie du Chien. Joanne M. McPoland, Dubuque. Mass of Christian burial 10:30 a.m. today, Church of the Resurrection, Dubuque. The Reverend Andrew G. Opendahl, Jr., Dubuque. Visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, December 11, St. John's Lutheran Church, Dubuque. Eileen H. Pierce, La Crosse, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 10 a.m. today, Blessed Sacrament Church, La Crosse. Funeral Mass 10 a.m. today at the church. Elsie E. Virtue, Platteville, Wisconsin. Visitation 3 to 8 p.m. Friday, December 11, Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. And finally, Isaac J. Weirs, I'll spell that, W-E-I-R-E-S, Isaac J. Weirs, Madison, Wisconsin. Visitation 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. today. Bear Funeral Home, Dubuque. And now turning to our regular notices, Ralph Muller, Monticello, Iowa. Ralph G. Muller was 80, and he died on Saturday, December 5th, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Visitation 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 9th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. Mass of Christian burial 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 9th, Sacred Heart Catholic Church, Monticello, burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Paul Baldwin will officiate. The cards and letters and memorials may be mailed in memory of Ralph Muller to Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. Please include the first and last name, Ralph Muller, on the outside of the envelope. Memorials may be made to Sacred Heart School, and as mentioned, KramerFuneral.com is handling arrangements, and at its website you can find full details and places for offering condolences. From McGregor, Iowa, Lorraine Ayers, 86, died Friday, December 4th. Private graveside service will be held. Memorial service will be held at a later date. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of McGregor is assisting the family of Lorraine Ayers of McGregor. Beverly J. Atkinson, Beverly Jane Atkinson, 80, of Dubuque, died Saturday, December 5th. A funeral service and celebration of life will be held at a later date. The Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family of Beverly Jane Atkinson. From Guttenberg, Jerry Guder, G-E-U-D-E-R, Jerry Guder, 79, died Saturday, December 5th. Private family service will be held. The Took Allen Funeral Home of Guttenberg is assisting the family of Jerry Guder. We have Stephen M. Edmonds, 74, of Dubuque, formerly of Galena, passed away on Friday, December 4th, at Unity Point Health, Findlay Hospital, from complications of COVID-19. Visitation, 9:30 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 8th, at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, where social distancing, face masks, and occupancy restrictions will be observed. Graveside services, 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, at Greenwood Cemetery in Galena. Online condolences may be left for the family of Stephen M. Edmonds at MullerFHED.com. Leslie Jackson, East Dubuque, Illinois. Leslie Hinderman Jackson. She was 90, and she died Sunday, December 6th. Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque is assisting the family for Lucille Hinderman Jackson. Jared Douglas Hubanks, 19, of Dubuque, died Thursday, December 3rd. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family, Jared D. Hubanks. Lois A. Gross, 74, of Warsaw, formerly of Dubuque, died Sunday, November 29. Resser Funeral Home of Warsaw is assisting the family. Rosemary Knobbe Reinhardt, K-N-O-B-B-E, Rosemary Knobbe or Knobby, Reinhardt, 83, of Dubuque, died Saturday, December 5th. Miller Funeral Home, East Dubuque, Illinois, is assisting the family. And on that page, we have listed one birth. On Sunday, December 6th, Joe and Christy Thane of Epworth, Iowa, are the parents of a girl at Mercy One, Dubuque Medical Center. And now turning to the sports page, we have a local sports story reported by Jim Leitner. Perseverance finally pays off for Fighting Saints. Ever since COVID-19 hit, we've kind of had our backs against the wall, but these last couple of games, we've been getting better and better as a team, and tonight was really our big reward, said Robert Cronin, who scored two goals, missed an empty netter by an eyelash, and set up one goal. Everyone played well tonight. Now we just have to keep moving from here. It's awesome to get the 2 points. We're really a good team, but we haven't been rewarded for it on the scoreboard. Tonight it finally clicked, and it felt great to win. It's going to be the first of many. Ian Pierce opened the scoring 6:37 into the game when his shot from the right point deflected off a Waterloo defenseman and past goalie Jack Williams. J.P. Fletcher won a face-off back to Pierce, who scored the first goal of his two-year USHL career. Just 73 seconds later, Fletcher scored a goal of his own to double the Dubuque advantage. He took a Connor Kurth feed on the right wing, skated in all alone, and wired a shot past Williams for his first goal of the season. Cronin made it 3-0 with his first goal of the season at the 8:22 mark of the period. He poked in a rebound from the doorstop after Braden Doyle and Daniel Zaniev worked the puck to the net front. "We've had some sloppy starts in the past, so we talked about getting strong before the game," Fletcher said. "We were prepared and we stuck with it. That's the key to the game right there. The energy in the room right now is amazing, and we're going to ride this momentum and keep it going." Owen Ozar pulled the Blackhawks within 3-2 by scoring the next 2 goals of the game. He potted an unassisted goal at 9:28 of the first period and added a power play marker 41 seconds into the third. Saints goaltender Aiden McCarthy finished with 27 saves, including several with the game still in doubt. He earned his first victory of the season in 4 appearances. "We were 0-5, but the last couple of games we played really well and were close, so it feels really good to get this off our backs," McCarthy said. "Hockey's a big energy game, and making those timely saves against a rival like Waterloo is big. We knew they were going to come hard at us, and we had to be prepared for anything." Cronin answered with the eventual game-winning goal, at 4:02 after Ozar's second goal. Zaniev hustled to keep the puck in the Waterloo zone. Cronin tried to make a centering pass, but it hit off the back leg of Jake Goldwaski and back to Cronin for an easy tap-in past backup goalie Charlie Glockner from the doorstep. Max Montez gave the Saints a little breathing room with his second goal of the season at 6:58 of the third. Cronin chipped the puck out of the Waterloo, springing Montez for a shorthanded breakaway. Montez lost his balance but regrouped and slid a backhander through Glockner's legs to make it 5-2. John Waldron gave Waterloo a little life by scoring with 3:46 remaining in regulation. "This is three games in a row where we've been getting better and better," Saints coach Oliver David said. "We built the big lead after the first 10 minutes, and we were able to hold it against a really good team. Even when they got to 3-2, we had a response, which is a big step for our team. This is the first positive pivotal moment in our season. We've been dealing with the coronavirus the first 10 weeks we've been together, and this is something we're going to celebrate tonight." The article is accompanied by an action picture of Dubuque's Max Montez scoring a shorthanded goal on Waterloo goalie Charlie Glockner during the third period Saturday night at Mystic Community Ice Center. And now we turn to the current page for a submission by Bobby Cornaroo. Deconstructing and understanding resilience. 7 things emotionally strong people do differently. Cornaroo is a board-certified radiation oncologist. He did his training at Northwestern University in Chicago and is an adjunct assistant professor at Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine. He sees patients at the Wendt Regional Cancer Center and Helen G. Nassif Radiation Center and the Leonard C. Ferguson Cancer Center. Again, the title of the article is Deconstructing and Understanding Resilience. I've served on the Board of Health in Dubuque County for almost 1 year. What started out as a volunteer position that was supposed to meet once per quarter became a position that often required weekly meetings and countless hours of planning to manage a pandemic. I can't speak highly enough about our board for the unpaid work they have done. As the holidays approach, I've decided to write about a topic beyond COVID. Regarding COVID, there is nothing I can say at this point that you don't already know. You know to wear a mask, socially distance, and avoid gatherings. You know that our hospital beds are full, our staff depleted, and community members are dying. You know the burden of responsibility that you carry. What I would rather discuss is that 40% of us suffered from at least one adverse mental health condition, including severe depression and anxiety during the past 6 months. Up to 25% of us have contemplated suicide. 50% of us have multiple comorbidities related to our overall health. The next 3 to 4 months will be more challenging than the previous 6 months. How will we get through this? If there is one skill set that we all need to improve, it's resilience. Resilience on a mental and emotional level, a physical level, and a spiritual level. I'm always inspired when I meet those who have learned this skill. Individuals who have lost loved ones, lost their job, and gone through a difficult treatment for cancer, but despite that have found the strength to persevere and transcend. I would first like to address emotional strength and resiliency. If you notice the patterns of emotionally strong people, they have behaviors that are different from the rest. And then he lists in bullet points a number of them. Here they are. They move on without getting stuck in the past. They have an outcomes-based approach rather than an emotional approach. They are kind, yet unafraid to speak up. They take calculated risks. They celebrate other people's successes without resenting them. They don't expect closure, apologies, explanations, understanding, or validation from other people. They embrace change and welcome challenges. These are great behaviors to work toward as you strengthen your emotional intelligence and resilience. I encourage you to look for models within the community who already embody these behaviors. Surrounding yourself with emotionally strong people eventually will rub off on you. It also is important to note that if one is suffering from mental illness, such as depression, then reaching out for help should not cast any doubt on your level of emotional strength. Asking for help and acknowledging that it's okay to not be okay is a sign of courage and should be embraced as well. That was by a doctor, Bobby Konaru, who is, is a board certified in radiation oncology. As I mentioned earlier, he did his training at Northwestern University in Chicago and is an adjunct assistant professor at Loyola University's Chicago Stritch School of Medicine. He sees patients at the Wendt Regional Cancer Center, the Helen G. Nassif Radiation Center, and the Leonard C. Ferguson Cancer Center. And on the Tri-State page, always exciting, Sundown Mountain opens for skiing. This is reported by Eric Hogstrom. Lauren Fitzgerald hopped off the chairlift Sunday and skied to one side of the top of the snow-covered hill at Sundown Mountain Resort as dozens more people set off down the slope. It's opening weekend. It's always exciting, said Fitzgerald, 26, of Dyersville, Iowa. Sundown opened under blue skies this weekend with man-made snow covering the beginner run and measures in place to lower the risk of COVID-19. We were in a strange position, said Mark Gordon, Sundown's general manager. We finished our season last year just about exactly when COVID began. The months in between gave Gordon and his staff an opportunity to watch and learn how other resorts prepared for skiers returning safely to slopes. We've had an ocean of time to prepare for this season, and it's been an interesting ride, watching COVID unfold this summer, Gordon said. We've learned a lot from New Zealand ski resorts. We learned a lot from some of the larger ski corporations that needed to make the adjustments and put them in place on an even greater scale than we did. There's been a lot of cooperation with managers of different resorts calling one another, asking, how are you doing it? And the sharing of that information has been quite helpful. Sundown requires visitors to wear face coverings when they enter a building or are lined up for chairlifts, as well as during all ski and snowboard lessons. Resort operators also recommend that visitors cover their faces when possible in outdoor public spaces at sundown. There are also changes indoors at the resort. We identified early on that our two major concern areas were our lodges and our rental facility, Gordon said. Our previous paradigm was how many people can we pack in the lodge? Now we have removed 2/3 of the seating in this North Lodge. One of the biggest challenges is our rental facility. We ended up purchasing an online registration system, SmartPass, which will allow people to get their rentals outside. One positive out of this is we feel strongly that the system which we put in place because of COVID will outlast COVID and allow people to expect to get on the snow, even on our busiest days, within minutes. Chestnut Mountain Resort outside Galena, Illinois, stated in a social media post Thursday that snowmaking continued at the venue, but there would not be enough snow to open this weekend. Gordon said about 350 people visited Sundown on Saturday and expected a similar number Sunday. Caleb Christensen, 16, of Asbury, Iowa, rode his snowboard both days at sundown. It was nice. There were a lot of people, Christensen said. Normally, I come out here almost every weekend. Gordon has served as Sundown general manager since 2014. He said he expects to be busy this season, in part because of restrictions on indoor activities prompted by the coronavirus pandemic. We have 75 acres of open area that people are craving, he said. Fitzgerald said she appreciated Sundown's opening. It's nice to have something to do that you can do, she said. There's a picture of an adult and a child, and the caption says, and they're both skiing parallel to one another. Looks like one giving a lesson to the other. And the caption says, Mark Rokusek helps his nephew, Noah Berger, 5, of Dyersville, Iowa, ski at Sundown Mountain Resort in rural Dubuque on Sunday. The pictures taken by Jessica Riley of the Telegraph Herald. And on that same page, high-speed internet continues to vex rural Wisconsin. This is reported by Bennett Goldstein. Nearly a quarter of rural Wisconsin households lack access to broadband internet, and although some gains have been made in recent years, analysts say upgrading connections to remaining locales represents the costliest phase of infrastructure investment. A new report released by Forward Analytics, the research arm of Wisconsin Counties Association, draws attention to the continued gaps in access to broadband internet defined by the Federal Communications Commission as a connection with a download speed of 25 megabits per second and an upload speed of 3 megabits per second. To some degree, the easiest stuff has been done, said Director Dale Knapp. We're now in places where the geography is not conducive to some of the broadband or the density is really sparse, so economically it's less viable. An estimated 36% of Crawford County residents, 21% of Grant County residents, 16% of Iowa County residents, and 29% of Lafayette County residents lack broadband access, according to the report. The figures reflect improvements in access of 26 to 33 percentage points since 2016. However, the data can overestimate the percentage of households with access to broadband because the FCC reports figures at the U.S. Census block level. If any household within a block has access, the FCC considers the entire block as one with access. But in rural areas, a block can span several square miles. Local governments can fill a needed role by drawing attention to underserved areas and assisting service providers as they seek state or federal grants, the report said. The state has taken steps to encourage broadband development, including the annual distribution of grant dollars to expansion projects and implementing a 2019 tax break on property used to provide broadband service to rural or underserved areas. The most reliable source of broadband, fiber optic wiring, is the most expensive to install. Only 20% of rural residents with access to broadband receive it through fiber, while the rest rely on cable, phone service, or fixed wireless connections through cellular towers, which do not consistently offer their advertised connection speeds. Bill Mitchell, a resident of rural Ellenboro in Grant County, relies heavily on the internet to run his design firm and art studio. Sometimes his internet connection, which he obtains through a copper phone wire, runs smoothly, but at times he can barely open his email, necessitating a trip to a nearby community. A lack of broadband also inhibits rural entrepreneurship, said Ron Brisboy, executive director of the Grant County Economic Development Corporation. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted the increasing demand for high-speed internet, not just for teleworkers, but students who attend school virtually. Amid the bluffs and farmland that surround the Cassville School District, some struggle to find or afford internet connections, said Superintendent John Luster. It is a strain, especially the longer that we're involved with this pandemic, he said. The district has provided mobile hotspots to families that need them. The article is accompanied by pictures of those mentioned, Dale Knapp, Bill Mitchell, and Ron Brisboy. And very briefly, an article, Dubuque Closet Helps Clothe Job Seekers. And it has a picture of Karen Babler, a volunteer with Women United, and helps organize the community clothes closet sponsored by Women United. It's located in Northeast Iowa Community College Town Clock Center in Dubuque. It lists information for its availability. It is open 7:45 a.m. to 5 p.m. Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Fridays, and as mentioned, located at 700 Main Street, Dubuque. People who wish to donate clothing can drop it off at the United Way office, 215 West 6th Street in Dubuque. And briefly, on Monday, the Dubuque City Council will vote on a proposed master services agreement with I'm On Communications to provide free Wi-Fi services at B Branch Linear Park in Dubuque. The partnership would be the first phase in a larger initiative to increase access to the Internet in Dubuque. And finally, Dubuque County reported 68 additional confirmed cases of COVID-19 between 5 p.m. Saturday and 5 p.m. Sunday. The county's 14-day positivity rate was 14.4%. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Monday, December 7. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.